behind Smile and Drama books, as well as the adapter and illustrator for Babysitter's Club series. And some of you might know that I was a huge comic strip fan growing up, and that's where I drew most of my inspiration from. So it's a big honor for me to get to interview Bill here today. And what we're going to do is Bill's going to show some slides, just sort of a quick overview of Foxtrot over the years. And then the two of us will converse about whatever comes up. And then if you guys have questions, we will spend the last 10 or so minutes of the panel turning it over to you. So,
sounds good.
Start with Bill.
Okay.
I need to scoot over.
Oh, yeah. How do you want to do this? Am I okay?
Actually, I'm just going to sit this. Thank you all for coming. Yeah,
if I start getting quieter and quieter, you can't hear me yell.
I learned years ago not to assume that people who come to see me to talk are familiar with my script. And so, this was working. Is there a...
It's not on anymore. So maybe there's something down there.
Sort of
sensitive reader who likes to call the editor and complain. So I try to navigate these waters and be as edgy as I can be in the context of the media. So here's an example of a really typical Foxtrot script. Nothing too weird about it. I've got the dad here saying, "Here you go, Paige. What's this? I heard you say you were out of Pimpaprine. There's a 128-ounce tube. Really think my skin is that bad? Wow." Some things shouldn't be purchased at Costco, dear. I got you that gray white hair dye. So that's like a normal flash. Be another one. I grew up reading Boone County when I was in college, and I always liked how he incorporated a lot of pop culture stuff in the strip and made it feel like it was really anchored in the present day, as opposed to a lot of comics where it could be 1950s, you know. So I do a lot of things with movies that have just come out and whatnot. So this one's sort of topical. OMG, did you see what Maddie posted on Facebook? And I got complaints for saying OMG. Hey, Nicole, can you hold on for a second? Not sure I like what the Hunger Games is. Generally, on the strip, Jason's the one, you know, with the dark gun, tormenting the page. So it's fun to sort of turn the tables now and then. Let her win. I was a physics major in college, which is not the traditional route to cartooning success. Somehow made it work. So this shield is sort of almost autobiographical. Got Peter at school, or I've got Peter blast shield down, commencing neutron burst, plasma field stable, X-ray emissions within expected tolerances. I have an imbalance in the fusion array. Recalibrating gravitron phase generator. It's working. All readings are normal. Ready to proceed with the experiment. Somehow I expected more from physics lab. Okay, people, let's begin by placing block A on the ring. 4 years of college in the day. This is about as exciting as it got. Because the strip has kids, a lot of the strips take place in school. This is one and a half years ago, Peter and his sister. And Paige is sort of a freshman every year. It's sort of a weird thing. People send me emails when she going to not be a freshman. So this would be early in the school year. Peter's saying, "What's that?" She says, "It's a map of me. It shows me the best route to take from class to class. Paige, you've been here for 2 weeks. You don't have the school layout memorized yet. Junior high was a lot simpler, okay? Just going from here to my French class, I have to walk down the hall, turn left at hunky Billy Hines' locker, turn right at totally hot Ricky Kirkman's locker, then make a right at to die for Mikey Peters' locker, and a final right turn after passing super fun Scotty Adams, Jimmy Davis's, and Danny Ferraro's lockers." Those are all cartoonist names. We will live in this trip. "Your French class is right here." I said the best group, not the most good. "Hey, hurry up. The bell rings in 15 minutes. And then I think, yeah. Oh. Here's Paige, Peter. "What's that?" "It's the Cliff's notes I have for this book I have to read for English class. It's for busy students like me who find the regular Cliff's notes too time-consuming. This one reduces Shakespeare's Hamlet to just a bare essentials. Danish prince dies." Nice. "Ah! You spoiled the ending. I hadn't finished the sentence yet." And being in newspapers, I'm obligated to golf strips. So I'm just trying to put my twist on it. Jason playing golf. "Square root of 16. Just yell 4, son. Now, For most newspaper cartoonists, doing a joke with Square Root of 16 would be the extreme edge of geekiness, and that would probably be the sensible limit, because you want people to get your jokes. However, as I said, I was a physics major, so I have a different boundary where I think it's acceptable. I think everyone knows what Square Root of 16 is. Oh God! So I end up doing scripts like this, where I don't know if you can see it, but basically I think Jason writing C code on the chalkboard that will print, "I will not throw paper airplanes in class 500 times." And I call strips like this my 2% jokes, because I know going into it, at most 2% of the audience is going to get the joke. But generally, if I do a good job with it, the 2% that gets the joke really likes the joke. And there's something to be said for having fans who don't just sort of politely laugh and really cheer. Because they're the ones that buy the books and, you know, come to conventions and line up to see you. So I've sort of made extreme geeky jokes a frequent but not too frequent occurrence in the strip, because I know I've got a core group of fans that really appreciate it. This one's a little less dweeby, but it's still pretty dweeby. Ms. Fox, about your lab report, is my data wrong? The data was fine. Were my results wrong? The results were fine. Was my procedure wrong? Your procedure was fine. What then? Between anaphase and telophase, cells don't go through something called smiley phase. Smiley phase. Get it? Man, if there ever was a teacher who needed some comic book, how cute, you made a little sad face out of your grade. Which I assume was a sign or something. I'm guessing last year, Apple came out with this iBooks author software that lets you create self-published ebooks for the iPad. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. It's free. I'll try it. And so I put together three little iBooks with 100 strips in each, and I sold them for $1.99. And the first week they were on sale, some of the tech blogs got wind of this and thought it was kind of a cool story that here was a mainstream cartoonist who had a publisher, but who was still self-publishing. And so they did little stories about me, and these tech blogs apparently have zillions of readers. So my sales spiked way up for a few days. And so I got what is the coolest screenshot I will ever have forever, which is the iTunes bestseller list. Steve Jobs biography. Yeah. And then my little homemade book that I did on the family iMac. And then Game of Thrones. So whenever I'm feeling down on my career, or whenever my publisher is getting a little too big for their britches, I'll say, you know, I did this without this. And then speaking of Game of Thrones, I did a strip last year, I guess, that was very popular on the internet. And now, season premiere, season two of Game of Thrones. Woohoo! My 9-month wait is over. Brought to you by Hasbro, creators of My Little Pony. Halt! Who goes there? I am Brony Baratheon, rightful king of the realm. My liege, the author of friendship. It is magic. I seek Brony Stark's counsel. Have you seen him? Ha, April Fools. We'll show the real episode now. Is anyone still there? Hello? Roger, why is our son looking for a pitch one? The only downside to the script is a lot of people assume that one of these bronies.
So you're not a brony?
Maybe you should explain the bronies.
There's an animated show, My Little Pony, based on the toy line. And it was originally targeted, presumably, at young girls, and somehow caught fancy of lots of guys. And not just little guys, but guys in college, and guys in their 30s or 40s. And they now have all kinds of brony message boards, and I think there's a BronyCon that's in the happen where it's coming. And it's become this really big thing. And people dress up in pony costumes and collect all the little toys and 45-year-old men. And they call themselves bronies. And then because there are librarians here, I thought I'd insert this last joke here. Paige and her friend Nicole. So did you hear about Craig and Michelle hooking up? I know, can you believe it? Back to quiet. The nerve of that librarian to kick us out. We were totally average when I was It's okay with that. That's what I brought. So we will move on from the audiovisual to the live performance.
Do you want to bring the chair closer? Okay. Thanks, Bill. I think it's pretty clear and easy to see why Foxtrot has had such a lasting legacy. Just sitting here and seeing a sample of scripts from the past 25 years, and each one is unique in its own way and speaks to lots of people in the audience and just makes us laugh, and that's what I love about it the most. So you mentioned that you felt like Jason was maybe the most kindred spirit among the characters, but what about as you've grown older? Like, have you started to identify with the parents in different ways, or have you changed your perspective on Jason at all?
Yeah, well, okay, so when I started this trip, I was 25, now I'm 50. It's kind of weird that when I got older than the parents in this trip, it was a weird...
And I don't mean to talk about mortality, by the way, it's just curious.
And so when I started this trip, I totally was 25, and I was actually 22 when I came up with the idea for this trip. So I was really identifying with the kids, and now I've got two teenagers. I still think I identify more with the kids than the parents, but I do find myself, like, with my own kids, getting mad at them for stuff that I know if it were in the context of the strip, I would think it was funny. But, you know, and definitely the Roger Fox Clueless stuff. When I started writing, I was thinking of my dad, and my dad's a doctor, he's very smart, but there's something about you go away for the whole work day and you come home and you come back into this chaos and you can't help but not know what the ground rules are. I feel myself in that situation.
Yeah.
And I work at home, I still have that problem.
Yeah, I'm more sympathetic to my adult characters now than I used to be too.
I do identify with all the characters, and that's probably normal for any writer. Because when I'm writing the dialogue, I'm sort of thinking, what would I do if I were Paige in this situation? What would I say? Okay, and what would I do about Peter in this situation? So there are little bits of me in all the characters.
As it should be. Can you tell us a little bit about when you were pitching to the syndicate? Were you Foxtrot from the very beginning, or did you have other ideas that you were developing as you were pitching?
Okay, so I came out of college with a physics degree, and generally physics majors went into grad school or teaching or somehow got a job at IBM or somewhere. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to make movies, actually. I wanted to work for George Lucas. I went to Amherst College in Massachusetts, which is a very traditional liberal arts school, and so you can't study film or animation or anything there. So I sort of took some classes freshman year. Physics was the class I thought was the coolest.
Okay.
You're sliding blocks down ramps, but you do get to shoot a laser now and then. And so I thought, well, I'll learn all this science stuff, and then I can go work for industrial light magic and make explosions and blow up Death Stars. I'd always drawn cartoons, and I drew cartoons for the school paper. And so when the letters to Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were not being returned, I started thinking, well, maybe I'll try a comic strip just to see what happens. As I mentioned, I really liked Bloom County, which was out at the time, and it just seemed like a pretty big job. But I knew it was, one in a zillion. So I came up with a strip that was not Foxtrot, and it was about a guy who goes off in the jungle and he's studying animals. And that was rejected. And the way syndication works is there are six syndicates that sell all the comic strips to newspapers. And so you mail off like a month's worth of samples to these syndicates, and generally they just return them with a Xerox and a rejection letter. And so my first strip, mailed it off. A month later, got back all the rejection letters. But the last rejection letter actually had a note at the bottom saying, we like your writing, we like your art, we like your humor, we're just not sure about the subject matter. So if you do anything else, please let us know. And that was enough encouragement for me to try a second strip. Had that last rejection letter just been a form letter, I would have just moved on to something else. And so the second strip I tried, I decided, well, if the problem is the subject matter, let's just pick a subject that's been done already that's pretty safe. I'll do a family strip. I'll just do it my way. So that's what Foxtrot was, but it still took 2.5 years sending off 4 weeks of strips, getting rejections, but they were encouraging rejections, like, well, try a little bit more. So
how many strips did you produce before the syndicate said yes?
Not a zillion.
Okay.
80 to 100 in there.
It was about
five
batches. Okay.
Initially it was like a 4 week batch, and then maybe a second 4 week batch, and then there were like 2 week batches. But like, I'd never drawn a Sunday strip ever, and then I got this contract to do Foxtrot, and I said, oh, we need 4 Sunday strips in a week. I was like, how do I color them? I had no clue what I was doing.
So you learned on your feet.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And so, I mean, if you could go back in time and do it all over again, do you think you would? Do you think if you were starting now, you would want to do?
Well, I really, really, really like the freedom to write and draw things without a filter. Like when I think back, I said I want to make movies. No writer in Hollywood gets to write a screenplay and see that screenplay on the screen. First of all, it's one in a zillion screenplay actually gets purchased and produced. But even then, they bring in all sorts of producers and whatnot, doc changes, and then they bring in script doctors whose names you never see in the credits. And so to a certain extent, it all becomes about the money and just saying, well, I got 20% of what I wanted on the screen. With Foxtrot, I write every word, and essentially my syndicate will proofread for spelling mistakes and missing, you know, commas and things. But so long as I stay within pretty obvious boundaries of good taste, I get to sink or swim entirely on my work, and I really like that. Now, if I were starting out today, I might prefer to work on the internet versus in newspapers because there's a lot more freedom, and with each year it becomes a little more economically viable. Mm-hmm. So.
But there's also a lot more competition out there.
Yeah.
The syndicate has to say, yes, we will put you in the newspapers, but the web is open to anybody who wants it.
Yeah, but,
which is awesome. And I'd like to believe that the cream rises to the top on the web as well, and that if it's good, it will find the readership. In rereading my old Foxtrot collections, I noticed in the first, like, several months of strips, you touched on, like, high schoolers going to parties where they were taking drugs, and, like, there was molestation going on, and there was some, like, really surprising content that I hadn't remembered reading about when I was 10. But was there any, like, examples of things that you did manage to get in the strip and that readers reacted to stronger than you would have expected, or...?
I got away with a lot of stuff in the first couple of years that I don't think I would get away with now. And part of that was, I think newspapers are more skittish now than they were back then, just because
the world
they're fearing for their lives.
Yeah.
But also back the first 2 years of Foxtrot, I was in less than 100 papers. And there wasn't an internet for people to say, oh my God, you've seen this horrible strip, you know, in the Dallas Morning News, and they don't listen to everybody in the country who's saying hate mail. And I think the reason I did it the first couple of years is I was close enough to college where I wrote about all kinds of stuff in the school paper without any flack. I thought, well, why would this be a problem? I didn't get a lot of negative feedback, but I got enough to sort of realize, okay, I don't want to do this too often.
Mm-hmm. And what was positive feedback? What was the initial response from readers that you had a hit on your hands?
With the strip altogether? I don't know. I still have trouble getting my mind around the fact that like if I go to, you know, a comic convention, know my work, you know, because I work at home, I sort of do it, and it used to be I'd stick it in a FedEx envelope, now I email it off, but, you know, it's not like I'm a stage performer and I see the audience and they're clapping. I sort of do my thing in isolation, mm-hmm. and then I get emails, but that's like virtual people, it's not real people, and so whatever fame my strip has, it's still hard for me to comprehend it. Early on, I probably had the opposite reaction, which was, you know, oh my God, I'm in 30 newspapers, I'm a rock star. But that quickly dispelled.
Yeah, please. Do you want to hear my story? Can I tell you my story?
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so I came to Foxtrot because when I was in fifth grade, and this was 87, 88, I was a comic strip fan by way of newspapers. I was reading Calvin and Hobbes, I was reading For Better or For Worse, I was reading Dennis the Menace, Parkside, and this was in the San Francisco Chronicle, because that's where I grew up, San Francisco. And my fifth grade teacher was this guy named Phil Abrams. And so my teacher comes into class one day, and he's like, hey, Raina, I see that you like to read comic strips. And I have this friend named Phil, and he's a cartoonist. And he plops down the first possibly 100 pages to a year of Foxtrot strips, Xerox, on my desk, like stapled together. He's like, check this guy's workout, you might like it. So I read through this whole, you know, Xerox stack of graphs. I'm like, this is amazing. Oh, wow, this is so cool. And my teacher says, and he told me, that if you want to send him your work for critique, he's willing to look at it. And I was like, I'm 10. And I was a shy 10, too. I mean, I was drawing cartoons, but I wasn't making comic strips just yet, so I was too shy to send you anything to look at, and I never did it. And I kicked myself for years, feeling like, oh, I had this amazing chance to, like, make a connection, and I didn't take it. So, yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, but then I became, obviously, a huge Foxtrot fan. I don't even think the first book had been published yet at that point. I don't even know if the strip was in papers yet. I know it was not in the San Francisco Chronicle until way later, for some stupid reason.
San Francisco Chronicle was, like,
they had a really small selection. It was just one page, and it seemed like the strips that had been there for a long time just stayed, and it was very unusual for a new strip to come in. But
to give you some, this may be totally boring, but I'll give you some insight into what's going on. So with comic strips, one of the weird things about doing a comic strip is your readers, who are the people you're trying to keep happy, they're not your customers. Your customers are the editors of the newspapers. And so you sort of want to keep both happy. And for whatever reason, San Francisco Chronicle bought Foxtrot, like practically from day one. And so I'm telling my parents, because I lived out there.
Yeah, you're still there.
I live in San Francisco. Woohoo! Chronicle's buying me. And I called my syndicator. When is it going to start? When is it going to start? Well, they're not sure. You know, they're assessing what strip they're going to drop. Because with newspapers, too, to add a strip, generally, you have to pull one out. And unfortunately, when a cartoonist dies, that doesn't even mean the strip is going to go away. And so waiting and waiting and waiting for the Chronicle to put me in. And a year goes by, and they still haven't added me, and I'm going bonkers. But because they were buying me, my syndicate couldn't sell me to the Examiner, which is also in San Francisco. And so I was just sort of trapped in this limbo of, I'm getting paid by San Francisco, but I don't get the bragging rights of telling my friends, see, I'm not a complete loser.
Well, you have one 10-year-old fan who was buying your books and showing them to her friends and trying to convince them to also buy your books.
And then they finally did add me, and got rid of me like 2 months later. And Herb Kane, who was their famous columnist at the time, wrote a column saying, like, "Thank God that god awful Foxtrot is out of our paper."
Oh, come on. That's terrible.
And then years later, Herb Kane died. And then a couple years after that, I got an email from a woman introduced herself as Herb Kane's secretary and saying how much she loved Foxtrot. It's so weird to imagine that, but it's this dynamic.
She's putting strips on his office door.
Yeah. Like, but anyway, they run me now.
Yes. San Francisco's taste has gotten better over the years. Can you talk a little bit about which is the kid edition of Foxtrot that came out from Andrews McNeil?
Yeah, my publisher, Andrews McNeil, has had huge success doing comic collections over the years. You know, all the Calvin and Hobbes books and the Farside books and all that. And one of the things they're trying to figure out is how to better get these comic strips that they do in front of kids. Because generally bookstores stick comic collections in the humor section, and mom goes into Barnes & Noble with little Tommy and Sally. Generally, they go off in the kids section, and they never see these books out. So, last year, I think, started sort of an imprint, like AMP Kids or something. And so I was part of their first wave of sort of experimental projects. And so what we did was we went back about 10 years ago and found a bunch of Foxtrot strips that we thought today's 9 or 10-year-old probably has never read. Sort of curated them to find strips that we thought our 10-year-old kids would find interesting, and we got rid of jokes about the X-Files and things that have, you know, been forgotten. And so this ad work is, my editor arranged them so that it's sort of like a year. It starts in January and ends around Christmas time. And it's hopefully going to do well enough that we do another one, because I thought, the title is A exclamation point. It's the screaming, and so I've joked to my editor, if I do a second one, I want to call it Z, 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 Z. And then have somebody sleeping on the front, you know. Because the salespeople on my publisher were not happy with the title choice. When they're on the phone and they say, well, okay, I got you down for 5 copies of it's just weird.
And where is that being shelved, in bookstores and libraries, do you know?
Presumably in the kids' department. I've seen it in my local book, Barnes and Noble. My publisher also does this Big Nate, not the graphic novel Big Nates, but the cartoon collection Big Nates.
Yes. And you mentioned to me that teachers have incorporated Foxtrot into their curriculums or given homework assignments that were based on comic strips.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool. Two things that I didn't expect to happen have happened because, as I mentioned, I do a lot of sort of geeky math jokes and stuff. Is I see my strip in my kids' textbooks often, which is really cool.
Wow.
My daughter's statistics class, there's a Foxtrot strip, and I got all excited, and my daughter's like, yeah, it was in my geometry book last year. And so that's pretty neat. My syndicate handles all that, so I never know that this is being done, and so I just living on that here about it. But I also get emails from science teachers and whatnot with problem sets they've done for homework assignments based on something I've done in the strip, either a specific math problem I've done in the strip, or, you know, Jason is shooting his spring-loaded dart gun at his sister, if the spring has this characteristic, you know, what angle must he aim this guy? That's really fun. I've got 3 siblings, and 2 of them are teachers, and so I like that there's a little bit of a teacher. And it's also fun because I don't know how you were as a kid, but I doodled a lot in my homework assignments and in textbooks and all, and so it's sort of a fun irony that I'm now getting paid to like have strips in textbooks.
Nice full circle feeling. Alright, well, why don't we open it up to the audience, unless you had...
Well, I don't know. I'm curious how your work got started and stuff, too. I don't know. Have you
heard of it? Well, I came up on comic strips, and I started making mini comics when I was in college. And they were short story comics that didn't really have any specific format. They weren't comic books, they weren't really either here nor there, and there didn't seem to be like a perfect market for them until Scholastic came along and said, hey, we are publishing graphic novels and they're going to be kid-centric and we want yours to be girl-centric, so I started.
Did you know somebody at Scholastic already?
No, they just found my mini comics at the comics convention.
Oh, wow.
And just liked my work and wanted to work with me. And at the time, manga was really big. Like, manga was the style to go for, the thing that all the publishers were looking for, but my style still didn't fit in with that either, because I'm such a comic strip influenced person. But so I started adapting the Babysitter's Club series into graphic novels, and that led to my self-written, self-drawn books. And it's been almost 10 years now since I've been doing this, and it's wonderful and rewarding. And I'm constantly telling kids who say, well, what other books are like yours that I can read? And I'm like, there's not a whole lot out there in the graphic novel market, but go back to comic strips. Go back to the old collections of Foxtrot, for better or for worse, you know, and this is where I come from. So I think that they will like it too. So I'd like to believe that I'm still going like this and bringing them back to you. So yeah, let's turn it over to the audience. And if you have questions for Bill, let's hear them.
You mentioned when you started out, like, Foxtrot was published in about 100 newspapers initially. Were you able to make a living initially, or did you have a day job, or...?
When I first signed the contract with the syndicate, Lee Salem, who was the editor, who signed me, his advice was, don't quit your day job. And I said, I have no day job. I'm living with my parents, and any money is awesome. When I
worked at the company where your teacher Phil had an office, I was making $8 an hour, and so even when I was in 30, 40 newspapers, it felt like a huge raise over the $8 an hour. But it took about 2 years, but again, I was single and didn't need a ton of money. It took about 2 years though before I started feeling like, okay, I'm making more money than most of my friends. But I was just psyched to have an outlet, and it was very weird. I went from literally living with my parents, no job, not published anywhere, to...
And your dad's a doctor.
Dad's a doctor, but to boom, running in, I think I was in 40 newspapers when it launched. I've been going ever since.
Bill, are you still doing daily shift, or is
no.
it just on Sunday?
Yeah, we didn't mention that. So when I first signed up, back when I was poor and young living with my parents, I signed a 20-year contract because I was told that was the standard.
And then?
It was 20 years. Well, no, there was a thing. I thought I was being smart, saying, "Well, let's have like milestones that have to be reached," but they were so low.
Yeah.
Somewhere around year 10, I was like, "Oh my God, I'm going to die. This job is killing me." And I begged and pleaded with my syndicate, like, "Is there any way to shorten this?" And they were like, "No." So I kind of knew as I was getting toward the end of the 20 years that all right, the plan is to reduce the workload somehow. And so the options really were either quit entirely, a la Calvin Hobbs, or scale back to doing something like Sundays Only, or hire people to do the strip with me or for me. And I decided that second choice was the one I was most comfortable with. So I do a Sunday strip only now.
Okay, that was
long answer.
That was kind of setting the stage. Have you ever thought of doing a long form narrative, like Foxtrot Family goes on vacation or something?
Yeah.
Like a graphic novel?
I actually, ironically, thought of doing that back like 15 years ago when I was still doing the strip and had no time. And now that I've got all this time, I'm kind of like, I don't want to do Foxtrot stuff, I want to do other stuff. It actually might be really fun to do something like that.
Whatever the Foxtrot movie would be.
Yeah, because the idea I had way back when was do like sort of like the Hardy Boys mysteries with Jason and Marcus, and go off and do these stupid things. So it wouldn't be a pure graphic novel like a comic book, but it would be spot art or scattered and this stuff. So it's possible.
Works well for Big Nate.
It does. Well, it's a funny story of Big Nate. So I have a friend from college named Phoebe, who's one of the senior children's editors at HarperCollins. And for years, like starting 12 years ago, we'd run into each other at book trade shows. She's like, "Bill, you should write a kid's book." And I was like, I know, I'm too busy. And she's like, "Oh, come on. And then the Wimpy Kid books came out, and she's like, "Bill, this is so perfect for you. You could do something like this, but it'd be even better." It's like, I know, I'm too busy. And so then I sort of semi-retired. And she's like, "Now you have no excuse. Do something." And I said, "I will, Phoebe, I will." And so I was trying to figure out an idea that was different than Wimpy Kid, because I didn't want to look like I was ripping them off. And so it took a while. And I went to my college reunion, and Phoebe was there. This was about 4 years ago. And she goes, "Have you ever heard of a strip called Big Nate?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, yeah." She goes, "Oh, well, I'm doing a book with him. You took too long." So, could have been me. But I think there's a lot of potential there. The only thing that now gives me pause is a lot of my comic strip friends are doing kids' books, and I'm wary of sort of doing what everybody else is doing. So my current project right now is I'm teaching myself to program iPhone apps, and doing a math app, like a Jason Fox theme. So that's pretty cool. I may make no money from it, but it's fun.
Enjoy.
Notoriously hard to reach and hermit-like. When I first started, maybe 5 or 6 months into my career, my editor Lee flew out to San Francisco and we were having dinner, and he said something like, "Oh, you've got a fan in Santa Fe." I was like, "Oh." He goes, "Yeah, Bill Watterson's a big fan." Oh, wow, that's really cool, because I was a big fan of Calvin Hobbes. And so when I got my... so then at Christmas time, sending out little Foxtrot Christmas cards, I decided it would be a good gesture to send them out to all the cartoonists that were also with my syndicate, because I hadn't met a lot of them. So I wanted to introduce myself. So for some reason, the secretary at the syndicate gave me the mailing addresses for all of their cartoons. I have no idea, you know, I must have called them the right day or something. And so I sent a Christmas card to Bill Watterson, and he wrote me back and said, "I don't know if Lee has told you, but I really like your strip, blah, blah, blah." So then I got him to write the foreword for my first book, which I'm sure quintupled the sales, because people are curious, what is the strip that Bill Watterson likes? So we corresponded for about 6 or 7 years, and he came over to my house a couple times. And I haven't talked to him in a long time, though. It's pulled back. But,
that's awesome. Any other questions? Yes, John.
Jason is obviously a very big Star Wars fan, and I remember Foxtrot as being one of the earliest, strips or anything that would make Star Wars references that it seemed like only Star Wars people would know. Now it's everywhere. Everyone, like, you can make a Star Wars reference anywhere, you can get it. But you were one of the earliest ones to do it. Have you ever, I imagine you're a fan, have you ever been to the Lucasfilm ranch? Have they ever said, "We see you're a big fan"?
I have a follow-up to this.
I have multiple Star Wars stories. where are we time-wise here? Story one, when I was in high school and I wanted to make movies and all, I got this crazy idea to make a Star Wars Star Trek spoof movie. And this was before digital video, so it was Super 8 and insanely complicated. And I ended up having 50 high school friends help. And we stole lighting equipment out of this theater department. But anyway, we made this 45-minute movie, and somehow it got the attention of somebody who knew somebody at Industrial Light and Magic. And so my buddy and I, who made the film with him, helped me make the film, we got invited to go up as 17-year-olds and tour ILM. And this was right after Empire Strikes Back had come out. And so they still had the little Snowwalker models sitting on shelves. And I got to touch R2-D2 and the... I was 17, so that blew me away. And then I got to, well, I'll skip some stories also. But then years later, around the time when they did The Phantom Menace, I think I did some more Star Wars jokes in the strip, and I got an email from somebody saying, "Hey, Bill, just want, I'm so-and-so, work at Lucasfilm, just wanted to let you know how proud we all are." So when the internet was brand new, when the web was brand new, and almost all the websites were just kind of hobbyist sorts of things, somebody had made a Foxtrot fan site. It had some clip art, it was really cheesy with flashing GIFs and stuff. And then it had biographical information about me. And it said that Bilgin was born in Northampton, Massachusetts, and went to Birmingham High School, and went to Amherst College. And then it said he worked in the model shop at ILM in the mid-80s. And I was like, well, that's totally wrong. Wonder where they
got. But don't correct it.
Wait, that's totally wrong. And so, by coincidence, I was talking to Scott Adams, who does Dilbert, and I said, I told him this. Or I said, what do you do if like somebody on the internet is like spreading an incorrect piece of biographical information about you? And he said, well, is it a good thing or a bad thing? And I said, it was pretty cool. As soon as I worked at ILM, they said, oh, leave it alone. So, left it alone, never thought anything of it. So fast forward about 4 years, I get this email. Hey, Bill, so-and-so from Lucasfilm, just want to let you know how proud everyone here is that one of our alums is doing so well. Congratulations on your success with Foxtrot. We loved the strip last week. And it was like, Gus and Bob in the model shop remember working with you. I wanted me to say hi. And if you're ever in the Bay Area, you know. So I got to get a tour of Skywalker Ranch. I had to fess up. I never went to the model shop.
Do you have a Bruce Springsteen story?
I do.
Yeah, okay.
if any of you, by any chance, follow me on Twitter, I have a bad habit of tweeting a lot of Bruce Springsteen YouTube links and things. And it's typically on a Friday night after I finish my strip on Deadline and I start drinking. I was obsessed with Bruce Springsteen all through college, and I still am. But years and years ago, there was a book expo in Los Angeles, and there was a fundraiser, and it was a band called the Rock Bottom Remainders, and it was basically a bunch of best-selling authors like Dave Barry and Stephen King and some others, and they found out they all played in bands in high school and whatnot. Hey, wouldn't it be great if we put together a band? So they put together a band as a charity thing to raise money against censorship. So they were having a concert, and my publisher had a bunch of tickets, and so my brother and I went and got there late, so they're finishing up. And they go, oh, we're going to play one more song. There's this guy who wants to join us. And Bruce Springsteen came out on stage. So my brother and I are like, woohoo, 10 feet from the stage in this little venue. And so Bruce didn't even sing. He's just playing backup guitar. And show's over. And then there's this side door to go backstage. And it's got a little velvet rope and a security guy in front of it. And every now and then, he opens the rope and somebody walks through. Brother, who's smarter than me, says, you know, these passes we have say sponsor. I wonder how far they'll get us. And so we walk toward the security guard, he moves the rope, and we go backstage, and we go back. And so now we're in the dressing room area. And there's this little room, it's maybe like 8 feet by 10 feet. And in it are Bruce Springsteen and Stephen King. And nobody else. And so my brother and I just sort of go in, because it was like, when else is this going to happen?
Yeah.
I said, hi, Bruce.
You were like, I've been talking about you in my comic strip that's in the newspaper. Or was this...
I might have said something like that, but I doubt he reads newspaper comics, so I was just happy to touch his hand.